Joining us now on ACT Radio, Wayne Pacelli of the Humane Society of the United States. Thanks for being with us, Wayne.
Glad to be with you. Glad to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's been about 13 years.
Wayne, I must not have done very well the first time.
You've not warranted an invite
for more than a decade.
Well, you've been too busy.
I'm glad to be with you.
Wayne, can you remind our listeners how you got involved in animal issues in the first place?
You know, it's been a lifelong passion of mine. When I was a kid, I had all of the encyclopedias in our home, dog-eared to all the animal entries. My favorite show was Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom in the evening, and the Saturday morning show was Aquaman.
It was aligned
with all of the marine creatures. And it was just my worldview. It was just the way I looked at other animals, and I knew they were different, but they were different in wonderful ways. They were beautiful and athletic and exotic, and I always had the sense that they should not be harmed, and certainly not in any gratuitous form. But I wasn't aware, like so many animal lovers, I wasn't aware of the breadth of exploitation that exists. And when I got to college, I started to really dive into the details. And I decided to become vegetarian, and then a month later I became vegan, and then I read Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it just affirmed all of my instincts, and it was right where I was thinking in terms of strategy as well, that I was concerned about all animals, but I was particularly concerned about those animals used in the largest numbers, like in industrial agriculture and use of animals in science for, you know, cosmetic testing and chemical testing. And Singer talked about taking on institutionalized forms of cruelty and taking a very broad view of our human relationship with animals and doing better. And right after that, I started an animal advocacy group in my sophomore year in college. And I've essentially been doing this full time, first as a volunteer, and then I was fortunate enough to begin to work full time for animals. And I've been very privileged to serve for nearly 12 years as CEO of HSUS, and we're headquartered in Washington, D.C., and take an all-animals approach.
I think Animal Liberation was the first book I read when I went vegetarian almost 40 years ago. It was strong and motivated a lot of people that are now vegans. And the three of us, Liz and Tom and I, are on the board of directors of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso. And we think that the most exploited animal are farmed animals, and so that's why we work hard to spread the vegan message.
Well, it's the largest number of animals at risk.
I mean,
the only other competitor would be the wildlife issues. If you add up habitat destruction, road building, roadkill, wildlife trafficking, the exotic animal trade, I mean, those numbers really begin to add up in a big way, but that has so many causes. This is a very specific use, and, you know, what I have a new book out called The Humane Economy, how innovators and enlightened consumers are transforming the lives of animals. And I spend, in the 8 chapters of the book, really 2.5 chapters are devoted to food and agriculture, and I talk about the revolution that's occurring, which, you know, when I started, it was almost an impossible scenario to imagine, where we're really on the brink of ending extreme confinement of animals on factory farms, where the animals are confined in cages and crates barely larger than their bodies. We've seen a cascade of the biggest food retailers in the country agree to phase out their purchase of pork and eggs from operations that practice this extreme confinement, immobilizing confinement, I like to say.
Mm-hmm.
And another aspect of this book, which I think is one other dimension of this issue, is the incredible innovation that's happening in food and technology with plant-based proteins and also the emergence of in vitro meat as new technologies to potentially, you know, eliminate the animals entirely from the equation, you know, in terms of those particular businesses. And it's quite an incredible dual track of established companies saying we're going to reject extreme confinement and embrace some aspect of animal protection, and then these entrepreneurs who are saying, hey, we can, you know, recreate the taste and texture of meat, we can have all the protein, we can have actually even more nutrients without any of the fat, cholesterol, hormones, antibiotics, and we can produce meat without a heart or a brain and not have a fully living organism that would suffer. And this is an incredible moment in our world to see these companies emerge.
Your book is very optimistic, and I have been a pessimist for a long time now.
We can attest to that.
But I find myself agreeing with you that we are in for big changes in future years. When I went vegetarian 40 years ago, I had to go to a kind of a hippie health food store to buy hot dogs in a can from Loma Linda. And now the major supermarket chain in El Paso is Albertsons. And in the last couple of years, they started carrying meat alternatives in the frozen section, Gardein and Beyond Beef and Beyond Chicken. Then just last year, they started carrying tofurkey and deli slices and other meat alternatives. I went in yesterday, and they had a whole big new organic produce section. Chain stores are changing.
There's no question. I mean, what's happened is there's now a critical mass of consumers who eat more plant-based foods. They may not be vegetarian or vegan, but they're flexitarians. They're eating less meat, and they're looking for these options for health reasons, environmental reasons, animal cruelty reasons. And there's been enough of this consumer activity to support the emergence and now the growth of so many companies doing plant-based foods. And this is one of the things that I talk about in the book, is that when you really see social change happening, you don't necessarily need 100% of the people on board. You know, it was 10 or 15% of the people who are really agitated, sometimes just 5%, that can drive a company to make big changes. And 5 or 10 or 15% of the public wanting some of these alternative products, then bringing them into the mainstream, so then they're no longer alternative products. They become the mainstream products. Mm-hmm. That is the dual set of things that's happening, where, you know, SeaWorld, for instance, is a company that was buffeted by a film called Blackfish.
Yeah.
And so many people got excited and agitated about what the company was doing that the company was really, you know, forced to change. And Ringling Brothers a year ago was forced to change because so many kids were unhappy with the way the elephants were treated, especially their travel all over the country and being on chains for 22 hours a day and on the road for 350 days a year. And again, once this small group, I mean, small, it's a lot of people, but it's a small percentage of people are informed, they can drive change, and then these ideas move from the margins to the mainstream. And I think in both your life and my life, we've been involved for decades. Mm-hmm. We see that this change has happened, and I think it's important to celebrate it. And in my book, I celebrate the change because we all need to feel like progress is being made in order to really tap into our reservoir of energy.
Something else you point out in the book is it's not only consumer demand that's driving change, but technological innovations like CGI in movies, replacing animals with computer-generated models.
No question. You know, in my book, I talked to Darren Aronofsky, who has done a bunch of really popular and commercially successful movies. And when he did Noah, I sat down with him at his offices in New York and Brooklyn, and I talked to him. I said, my God, you know, what movie has a higher degree of difficulty than Noah in terms of representing the animal? I mean, you know, two of every kind of animal are needed. And he knew that he could not go to one of these animal actor agencies. He originally had no awareness of the problems associated with these trainers keeping animals and then sometimes subjecting them to violence and coercion in order to get them to perform, and, you know, the living conditions for the animals. Apart from that, he just basically felt like, hey, that's a small barnyard full. I could get some camels. I could get some goats. I might be able to get a few wild animals, but I'm never going to be able to represent this.
Okay, get the dog into the wolf costume.
Yeah, exactly. But with computer-generated imagery, he was able to create an incredible diversity of life and represent that diversity in his movie in a way that was much more complete, much more vivid than live animals would have been able to achieve such an effect. And it made it a better movie. So it was a better movie, better animal representation, so animals were still at the center of the story, but without using live animals and causing them any harm. That is a win-win. It's a win on the morality and the ethics of the issue, and it's a win on the economics because he had a better movie, which is going to mean greater commercial success. And that's really the thesis of my book, is that, you know, when I started in this, like you did, it was really a polarity. It was, okay, are we going to do the ethical thing, or are we going to do the pragmatic and economic thing? That the notions were at odds, that you were going to have to choose. You're going to have to sacrifice if you wanted to do the right thing for animals. Now it's not a sacrifice. Now it's an opportunity. And we, by doing right for animals, we're going to be better businesses. They're going to succeed in the marketplace. They're going to be better movies. They're going to have more viewers. The food is going to be better. It's going to be more nutritious. It's going to be healthier for us. It's not going to have any of the environmental externalities. And this is really why I wrote the book. I want to reframe the debate and the discussion about animal issues. It's not about sacrifice. It's about opportunity.
Well, and I mean, some people will still, you know, be arguing that although the animals are, you know, not confined in cages anymore, they're still suffering, and that we should take a very hardcore stance and not even promote things like free range because it perpetuates the illusion that animals aren't suffering when they're suffering in different ways in these free range operations.
Yeah, another way of saying that is that the animal welfare movement might be retarding the animal rights movement.
I mean, I think that there are always going to be fault lines within any cause, and there will be people debating tactics, and there will always be pressure on the reformers to not take what are viewed as incremental steps or not take actions that would undermine the end game or the end goal. I just think that this issue is so tremendously complex sociologically and culturally. I'm not willing to wait until everyone becomes vegetarian and vegan. I think, you know, the data show that a small percentage of people are vegans. A slightly larger but still very small percentage of the public is vegetarian. I think that these animals need relief right now. And I think getting them out of cages and crates that immobilize them is a moral imperative, and we should seize the moment. That doesn't mean we should say that eggs from a cage-free operation or a crate-free operation is, you know, perfectly humane. There are lots of other animal welfare problems associated with it, but it's progress. And, you know, the metric that I use in the book and that I talk about at HSUS is progress, not perfection. You know, all of us are sinners when it comes to animals. We all have had some aspect of our lives that was imperfect. The key is that we're thinking, we're critical, we're questioning, we're striving, we're trying to do better each day. And when companies like Walmart, you know, a low-cost retailer, say, yes, we can do this, we can rid our supply chain of these cages, it is our duty as a movement to support a company's move like that. And, of course, progress begets more progress. When these companies feel embraced, when they take pride in making a positive decision for animal protection, they're going to take other actions. I think it's just basic psychology. It's psychology 101. And I think we need to be encouraging. Doesn't mean I want to stifle and choke off discussion about these issues in our society. And certainly, you know, we shouldn't overstate or overrate these reforms. But I think we've got to recognize its progress. We've got to celebrate it and then ask people to continue this long-term process thinking about our proper relationship with animals.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you attribute the progress to, Wayne, is Prop 2 in California. How important do you think Prop 2 really was in all the changes that we've seen in just the last 8 years?
You know, I think it was one of those moments where you kind of assess where you are as a movement. You know, we think we're making progress, but then you get kind of a cold reality check where voters reject you or, you know, you lose a big bill. There were a lot of people questioning our decision to bring Prop 2 forward in California. It was a ballot initiative that was voted on in November 2008 to stop the confinement of veal calves, breeding sows, and laying hens. People thought, well, we're going to take on too much. They're taking on three different sectors of ag. The rest of ag is going to come after you. It's the number one ag state in the U.S. in terms of receipts, which is California. They've got one of the biggest egg industries in the U.S. You know, they will create confusion. They will frighten people about food costs. They'll tell people farmers are going to go out of business. Well, they did all of that, and they spent millions of dollars, and voters sided with us by nearly a two-thirds vote. That was an incredible wake-up call to the entire agriculture community. It was a warning shot to the food retail sector, where they realized overnight that their conventional practices were out of step with prevailing public sentiment. It was just a single vote in a single state, but it's a very important state, a very diverse state, and we showed that we won not just in the Bay Area of San Francisco, but we won in Southern California, including the Inland Empire. We won in the Central Valley, which is the heart of the agricultural economy of California and in so many ways of the nation. And it was, you can draw a straight line from Prop 2 to more than 120 announcements that we have made with big food retailers to change their purchasing practices and stop buying eggs and pork and veal from operations that confine the animals. And frankly, the National Milk Producers Federation has pledged to end tail docking by 2017. We followed up Prop 2 with a tail docking ban in California, which is the number one dairy state. I mean, so much came from Prop 2. It didn't unfold, you know, without further work, but it was a turning point. And you need these big battles as a movement to show where you are. And if you can take on the toughest adversary and you can beat them, especially on their home terrain, it's a very, very big deal.
Right. And sent a message, you know, speaking of economy, sent a message to the biggest egg producers in the world and other industries that if they wanted to have a stake in the market that is California and how big that is, they really had to start considering other business practices.
And you know, just the whole the market is so big. It's 12%. You know, it's 38 million people, you know, in a country of more than 300 million. It's just big. You think about all the McDonald's outlets there. You think about all the, you know, Chili's. You think of all the supermarkets. If they have to change their purchasing practices to conform, and it wasn't Prop 2, but it was the follow-up measure that we did, AB 1437, that said that if you want to sell eggs in California and you're from out of state, if you're from Iowa or Indiana or Ohio, which are the big egg-producing states, in addition to California, then you must conform to Prop 2 standards. That really upended the egg industry. And, you know, now it's incredible. My colleagues and I, every day, my team is talking to the biggest food companies in the U.S. They're making pledges. They're making announcements. This issue is going to be settled. Now, it's not overnight. They've got phase-in periods for these egg purchases. But the end of cage confinement is here. And in the last 6 months, we have leapfrogged Europe. Europe was way ahead of us on laying hen welfare issues. Now we're ahead of them because they have colony cages in a number of countries as an enhanced or enriched and larger cage. The United States is skipping that step entirely. We're going right from battery cages to cage-free.
And in your book, you say something like about 85% of egg-laying hens are still confined. And that's a much smaller number than I've seen in past years. It seemed like it was like 98% a few years ago.
Yeah, it became conventional. It was the standard tool of the industry. So pretty much everyone was doing it. If you didn't do it, you were a specialty egg, right? So
Yeah. The
cage-free or the pasture-based, pasture-raised was a specialty egg. Now cage-free is going to be the norm, and then the specialty stuff is going to be, you know, free-range. It's going to be vegetarian-fed. It's going to be detailed. And, you know, just this last week, the Obama administration and the USDA announced the proposed rule on organic standards.
Oh, good.
The original organic standards, which we worked on very hard, had very little to do with animal welfare. Now this is codifying, in terms of the legal standard for organic, the anti-crating, the anti-tail docking, so many of the elements of our campaigns are going to be kind of blended into the organics definition. So, again, we've got a long road to hoe, and we have many, many challenges, and animals are still at risk in so many settings. But, by God, this is tangible progress for us.
We've been talking with Wayne Pacelli, the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, and author of the new book, Humane Economy. We only covered a little bit of your book. Can you join us again for another show?
Indeed. I'd love to be back.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us, Wayne.
Great to be with you.